Today's lecture is going to be all about the shape of things again, shape of manifold space of shape of space-time. And let's remember where we were. So the non-trivial shape of a manifold reveals itself in many ways. So if this indicates some kind of curved manifold or space-time, space or space-time, then one of the features of the presence of curvature is that the sum of the angles in a triangle is not 180 degrees. If there's a right angle, there's no reason anymore that a squared plus b squared would be c squared, and so on. And there are approaches to quantum gravity which capture curvature in this way. And in your essay, you may want to refer to some of them. However, there's other ways to describe the non-triviality of the shape. And that could be, for example, through the non-triviality of parallel transport of vectors along closed trajectories. And we found that we can indeed encode the shape of a manifold through the so-called affine connection, so the manifold M and an affine connection gamma, together encode the shape of a manifold. And of course, the first description we had was through a metric. And then last time we found out how they are equivalent. There is a major drawback of both the metric description of the shape of a manifold and the description of the curvature of a manifold through the affine connection. And this major drawback is that these descriptions are super redundant. They don't get to the point, so to speak. This is not distilled information in any way. There's a lot of junk information in there that is human-made and doesn't describe the properties of the manifold. Now, what I mean is this. Imagine we have two manifolds described by M and G and M and G prime, two different metrics. Then you might think, OK, so they would describe two different space-times. But that's not so. It can very well happen that you're given two manifolds with metrics on them, and actually they describe the exact same space-time. Basically because they are just differing by changes of coordinates. But you can also explain this in a coordinate-independent way. So if we have two different metrics, then still the Riemannian or pseudo-Riemannian manifold that they describe must be considered equivalent. This is to say they must be considered as describing the same space or the same space-time if there exists a metric-preserving isomorphism between the two. If there's a diffeomorphism, an invertible diffeomorphism from the manifold, from the one manifold into the other manifold, I could have put a prime in here too, it doesn't really matter. If I have an invertible diffeomorphism from one manifold into the other, that also preserves the metric, then we have to say that this describes the exact same space-time. And by preserving the metric, I mean that if you take the map from one manifold into the other manifold, I hope you remember these pictures that we had in the earlier lectures, a manifold here, a manifold there, and then there was a diffeomorphism from one to the other, and then that induced pullback maps of the tangent spaces into each other, and the cotangent spaces, and the function germ spaces, and so on. Well, in the same process, you also have a pullback map that maps the space of tensors that are of rank 2 and covariant, such as the metric, into each other, right? So you have a diffeomorphism from one manifold to the other. It's invertible. And it maps the function germs into function germs. It maps tangent spaces into tangent spaces and cotangent spaces into cotangent spaces, tensor spaces into tensor spaces, among them the twofold covariant tensor spaces to which the metric belongs. And then you can check whether under that pullback map, the metric that you map from one manifold to the other agrees or doesn't agree with the metric that you have in the second manifold. If it does agree, you're saying, okay, I'm preserving the metric here. And then you are literally describing the same thing. You can view it this way. Oh, here's actually a small picture of this. So you have here the manifold with one metric, the manifold with the other metric, and you have the pullback maps. And then imagine you have a chart from one of these manifolds into Rn, the coordinate system. Then you can extend that to another chart by simply concatenating that chart map with this map, with this diffeomorphism. And so overall, you just have the same metric structure, but described with two different coordinate systems. So what are we going to do about this? You may wonder, is that really a problem? I mean, fine, we have different ways of describing the same thing. Why would that be a problem? Well, it will be a problem in quantum gravity, and I'm getting to that in a moment. For now, let's try to distill the actual geometric information. What is it that describes a space-time? Is it a manifold with a metric on it? Cannot be, right? Because there are other manifolds with a metric on it that describe the exact same space-time. So you can't identify space-time with a manifold and a metric on it. No, you have to identify the space-time with an equivalence class of manifolds and metrics, where two manifolds and metrics are considered to be equivalent if they're related by an invertible diffeomorphism that maps the metric into the metric. So here's a definition. We say that such an equivalence class is a Riemannian structure or a pseudo-Riemannian structure. Exactly, the definition is this. A pseudo-Riemannian structure, let's call it capital Chi, is an equivalence class of pseudo-Riemannian manifolds which can be mapped into each other via a metric-preserving diffeomorphism. That is to say, via changes of coordinates. So what that means is that we're describing a space-time not by giving manifold and a metric, but by giving an equivalence class of manifold and metrics. Now, of course, we don't have to write down that entire equivalence class. We can just take one representative, one manifold and a metric, and say, this describes my space-time in the sense that, well, that's one way of describing it. I gave you one representative out of that equivalence class. Any other manifold with the metric with a metric on it that is isomorphic to this one describes the same thing. And you will see in a moment why it makes a difference. You see, for classical general relativity, it's not that important. But as soon as quantum theory comes in, this will be super important. It's kind of, I would say, the main reason why we don't have a theory of quantum gravity yet. So let's do this very carefully. So still everything is classical here, and what we are saying is that space-time will be modeled as a pseudo-Riemannian structure, capital Chi, that is to say as an equivalence class of pairs M and G, where M is a manifold, G is a metric, and two of these are considered equivalent if there's an invertible diffeomorphism that preserves the metric under the pullback map. The problem arises, a problem that soon will be clear that it's important, is that it's very hard to handle these equivalence classes. It's very hard to actually work with them in the sense of identifying who is in that equivalent, who is in a given equivalence class and who is not. And that's because in practice, it is super difficult to check whether such a metric preserving diffeomorphism exists or not. Imagine somebody gives you a space-time by writing down a manifold and says, okay, that's my manifold here, and that's the metric that's on it. Okay? So imagine you're given a traditional description of a space-time manifold. like whole space-time or something, right? So somebody tells you that in my chart, I have a chart and the parameter values range from this to this, and the metric in this chart, in the coordinate, canonical coordinates is such and such. Okay, fine. And now somebody else comes along and says, oh, I have a space-time too, and writes down similarly, you know, the manifold and the metric on it, explicitly as functions, the metric, all the matrix elements as functions. And then you may wonder, hey, did I just see two space-time manifolds or one? Is this the same space-time or not? Now, how can you establish that? How can you find out whether or not the two are the same? Well, in principle, what you have to do is to check whether there's a diffeomorphism, an invertible diffeomorphism that preserves the metric. So all you do is you take the first diffeomorphism that comes to mind, the first change of coordinates that comes to mind, and check whether it maps the metric as given here into the metric as given there. If you find it doesn't, then you're not done. Because there could be another diffeomorphism that does it. And so you get to check infinitely many, in fact, continuously infinitely many possibilities for diffeomorphisms, for changes of coordinates that might achieve that the metric before matches the metric afterwards, the two manifolds. If you achieve that, if there is a diffeomorphism between the two that maps the metrics, then you can say, yeah, okay, they're in the same equivalence class. Actually, I'm dealing with only one space-time, because they are part of the same Riemannian or pseudo-Riemannian structure. But you can't actually try out all possible diffeomorphisms. Now, sometimes we are in luck. For example, somebody could give you a Minkowski space. And you know that the Minkowski space, the curvature tensor, is zero everywhere. You can easily calculate that too. Because the Minkowski space in flat coordinates, Cartesian coordinates, easy to show. The Christoffel symbols are zero. And so the curvature tensor is vanishing and so on. And then somebody else comes along and gives you another manifold with a metric on it. And you calculate the Christoffel symbols, and you calculate the curvature tensor, and you find that there are places where it's not zero. Then sure, of course, there cannot be a diffeomorphism between the two. Right? Because a tensor, if it vanishes in one coordinate system, it vanishes in all coordinate systems. But in general, if somebody gives you two generic manifolds with metrics on them, there's going to be curvature all over the place. And it's very difficult to find out whether or not you can rearrange the coordinate system such that you find out it's the same thing. So it's very difficult to check how all of the manifolds with metrics on them organize themselves into these equivalence classes. Now, what we would like to do for quantizing gravity is to be able to reliably identify exactly one representative out of each of these equivalence classes. If we could do this, we would call this the fixing of a gauge. Just like in electromagnetism, where you know that there can be different field configurations, A mu, that describe the exact same electric and magnetic fields. So the physics is the same, but you have different A mu's. And in electromagnetism, when we do the path integral over all A mu fields, we have to be careful. If we integrate, if we path integrate over all A mu fields, then we are overdoing it. We are overcounting. Because we get A mu fields that describe the same physics multiple times, in fact, infinitely many times. So the way we do quantize electromagnetism is that we first choose a gauge by putting a requirement on the A mu. I hope you have seen such gauge fixing conditions before. So you put a gauge fixing condition on your electromagnetic field, and the aim is that this gauge fixing condition is obeyed by only one representative out of each gauge equivalence class. And then you sum over those. And then you can do quantum electrodynamics. Now, in gravity, similarly, we would like to do a path integral over space times over Riemannian structures. But how to do that? Nobody knows yet. So why would it be useful if we could fix the gauge in gravity? So quantum gravity. Remember, there are different ways to describe the curvature of space-time, deficiency angles, non-trivial metric distances, non-trivial parallel transport. But what is best for quantum gravity? But remember that quantum theories can be described in two different ways. You can either use operators and commutation relations and Hilbert spaces, or you can do it the Feynman way, where you pass integrate. Now, dealing with operators has advantages. Operators and Hilbert spaces has certain advantages, but also disadvantages. In particular, working in the operator framework is not manifestly covariant. You can keep it covariantly, you can keep it covariant intrinsically, but it doesn't look covariant because you're singling out the time coordinate, energy operator, the Hamiltonian. So in a theory such as gravity, where covariance is paramount, it's nice, it's almost necessary to keep the covariance explicit, which is why it would be much preferable if we could quantize gravity in the Feynman way. Because in the Feynman way with the path integral, you don't have to break any symmetries. You don't have to single out a time coordinate. Now, the Feynman way is the sum over all paths way, path integral. And if you do first quantization in the Feynman way, then you have to literally add up the probability amplitude for a particle to go from here to there by all possible paths. So every path gets an action, e to the power I times the action is the probability amplitude for the particle to take that path, and you sum up these probability amplitudes over all possible paths, and then you get the total probability amplitude for it to travel from here to there. In this way, you can actually calculate the propagator. That you could also calculate by calculating the Green's function, the unitary time evolution operator of Hilbert space, and then take position eigenvectors left and right to it. Same thing. Amazingly, it's the same thing. But in quantum gravity, we would like to do a path integral of roughly this structure. We sum up not over paths that an electron can take from one point to the other, but instead, we sum over all possible evolutions that space-time might undergo. You see, the path now is not the trip of an electron. The path now is space-time evolving in time. So we would have to sum over all possible evolutions that space-time can have, and every one of these evolutions gets a probability amplitude. So we calculate the action for some space-time evolution, and then e to the power I times that action would be the probability amplitude, and we have to sum all of that up. That would be the partition function. And that's the basic quantity. We can then decorate that with so-called Schwinger sources, and then the derivatives with respect to that would give us correlation functions and so on. But that's the basic quantity, the partition function. And it would have the structure of an integral over all possible space times, and that means all possible evolutions of space. You have to plug them into the action, calculate this probability amplitude, which is a complex number, and integrate all of this up. But what does it mean to integrate up over all possible space-times? It doesn't mean integrating up over all possible manifolds with metrics on them, because that would be overcounting. The same space-time can be described in many different coordinate systems, so with the help of many different manifolds with metrics on them. They just differ by coordinate system changes. So what we have to do in quantum gravity is, in principle, to do what we do in quantum electrodynamics, which is to say, we want to integrate over all Riemannian structures, which is to say, integrate over all equivalence classes. Every equivalence class will have the same action, of course, because the action depends not on the coordinate system. So we do a sum or an integral over all possible Riemannian structures, all possible shapes and evolutions of space-time. And that could mean we sum or integrate over one concrete representative out of each gauge equivalence class. And we can write it like this, that we do an integral or a sum over all possible metrics. Over all possible metrics, and we calculate the action in here, and we put a Dirac delta in here that does the gauge fixing, that a condition we put in here in the argument of the Dirac delta, a condition that's obeyed by only one representative out of each of the equivalence classes. So this could be all metrics, or it could be all affine connections. Somehow we would have to put some gauge fixing condition there. It's just that we don't know how to do that. Maybe one of you figures it out one day. Then if we could do this, this would be great. You see, the main difference is that gravity is highly nonlinear. And with a theory like electrodynamics, it's much easier because it's linear. Okay, so this is just saying that much of quantum gravity research can be viewed as trying to solve that exact problem, how to do a path integral over all space times. Now, we could do it with one of two strategies. We can either say, okay, we know how to write space times in terms of the metric or the affine connection, but in any case, in a highly redundant way. Because the gauge equivalence classes are so big, these Riemannian structures have so many elements in them. Or we could try to find yet another description of a space-time which is not redundant. See, here the idea would be that if we can describe the shape and evolution of a space-time in terms of a bunch of numbers that are coordinate system independent, that non-redundantly describe the space-time, then we could do a path integral over those numbers, over those geometric invariants. And we wouldn't have to bother with this gauge fixing and equivalence classes and all of that. But can we think of a way to describe the shape of a manifold without even using a coordinate system? Now, there are some quantities that one can think of. For example, if, let's say, we have some sort of metal ball. There's some sort of two-dimensional metal surface. And it's not spherical. Let's say it has a potato shape. Then what can we say about that shape without referring to a coordinate system? One thing we could say is its volume, right? The volume is a number right there. And you can, if you want to calculate that number, you have to integrate the volume of the ball, right? And for that, you choose a coordinate system, and you do the integration, you get a number. But it's clear that that number, the volume, is independent of which coordinate system you chose. In some coordinate system, it might be easier to calculate the volume, and another one might be harder, but the number that comes out of it is always the same. So the volume is a geometric invariant, and so is the area. In fact, it's much better to work with the area, because in order to have even a notion of volume, you have to embed your two-dimensional surface. 3 plus 1 dimensional space-time doesn't have to be embedded in something higher dimensional. It could just exist on its own. Wrap your mind around that, right? The surface, a two-dimensional surface, doesn't have to be enclosing anything three-dimensional. It can just exist on its own. We can describe shapes without embedding them in a flat, bigger space. That was a key insight of Gauss and Riemann and others. That our space-time, our 3 plus 1 dimensional space-time can be curved without being curved inside something else, higher dimensional, that has to be flat. It might be, and there are theorems about the embeddability of curved space-times in higher flat spaces, higher dimensional flat spaces, but it's also not necessary. Okay, so we know, for example, some quantities now that are coordinate system independent and tell us something about the shape of an object, such as the shape of this metal ball, the area, for example. But are there any other? Can you think of other quantities that you could calculate from a shape that depend on the shape and only on the shape, and that you can calculate, and the number that comes out of it, it does not depend on how you calculated it? right? I mean, for example, you could calculate the Christoffel symbol everywhere on your manifold, on your metal ball. But the values that the Christoffel symbols take is dependent on the coordinate system that you choose. And the same with the metric. It depends on the coordinate system that you choose. I'm asking here for numbers that you get from the shape that do not depend on the coordinate system. If we can get enough of them, enough numbers, to describe all of the shape, then we are in business. Because then we can try to quantize shapes, or the evolution of shapes, by looking at the dynamics of these quantities, and the path integral over these quantities, over these geometric invariants. Now, can you think of some numbers that you can get from shape?
The distance between points.
Yeah, but how do you do that? You would have to give them names, and then you would have to specify which point it is, and then you're in the business with coordinate systems again. Now, what you can do is this. Just a second, we borrow this. and let me borrow that one. See, if you tap this, you get a certain sound. And you could spectrally analyze what the sound is, what the frequencies are in there. You see, this mug has eigenfrequencies that depend on its shape. If you took an object of a different shape, it would have different frequencies at which it vibrates. And these frequencies, you can measure, but you can also calculate them. You have to solve a wave equation on the surface of this thing. And then you can calculate, then you can get these frequencies. You can measure them, you can also calculate them. And these frequencies, do they depend on the coordinate system? No, obviously not, right? Because I didn't even use the coordinate system, right? You just tapped the thing, and it had a certain sound, and the sound doesn't care about any coordinate system that you use. And the eigenfrequencies, yeah, your mug is special. And the eigenfrequencies, in principle, there are infinitely many of them. So we have infinitely many numbers that are geometric invariants. See, if you take a mug of different shape, some of these numbers are going to change. And you could imagine that if you listen to a lot of mugs of different shapes, that after a while you start getting an idea. Oh, the bigger mugs have a different sound from the smaller ones. And the ones with a handle sound differently to those with no handle or two handles or whatever. Right? And the shape of these things will all have an imprint on the sound. Now, in 1911, Hermann Weyl asked how much of the shape of an object is determined by its sound. Now, remember, that was before general relativity, and it was before quantum theory was understood. It was underway. Both were underway, but none had been understood. But the mathematics of this, the mathematics of what is called spectral geometry, spectrum of the geometry, right? The mathematics of spectral geometry I find is super interesting because, if you think about it, it involves two branches of mathematics that have ordinarily very little to do with another. One is the mathematics of shape that we have been developing here over some weeks. Mathematics of shape, differential geometry. And it involves solving for eigenvalues of operators, which is functional analysis, the language of quantum theory. So spectral geometry is a discipline of mathematics that naturally combines differential geometry, the language of general relativity, and functional analysis, the language of quantum theory. And it's clear that whatever the theory of quantum gravity is eventually going to be, it's going to involve those two pieces of mathematics very centrally, because quantum gravity must reduce to general relativity in some limit and must reduce to what we know about quantum theory and quantum field theory now in some other limit. So clearly, these two theory disciplines must be combined in quantum gravity. Okay, so let's look at spectral geometry. What can spectral geometry do and what can it not do? Now, more than 100 years after Hermann Weyl. So the idea is that the manifold vibration spectrum, lambda m, lambda n, the set of frequencies with which it is vibrating depends only on the shape of the thing. It only depends on the Riemannian structure. It doesn't depend on the individual representations. It doesn't depend on coordinate systems. So then Weil asked, how much of the shape, maybe everything, is described by these geometric invariants? Now, there are some caveats that we have to mention right at the beginning. First of all, the eigenfrequencies cannot describe the shape if whatever object we deal with has an infinite volume or infinite area. It's just infinite in size. Because then the spectrum is generally not discrete, but continuous. But then there's very little information. Right? Because just a continuum anyway. Now, there are ways around this. You could take a chunk of it, like if your mug is infinite in size, you take a chunk of it and look at its spectrum and then make the chunk bigger and bigger. The spectrum then gets denser and denser. As the volume that you consider goes to infinity, the spectrum becomes continuous. In the limit, it becomes continuous. So the eigenvalues get closer and closer, and limits, it becomes continuous. But you can scale your spectrum with the volume such that in the limit, the scaled spectrum stays discrete. It's a messy thing, but in principle, that can be done. Also, the spectral geometry of pseudo-Riemannian manifolds, the ones with the indefinite signature, unlike your mug, which is just an ordinary Riemannian manifold, the spectral geometry of pseudo-Riemannian manifolds is very little developed. A lot to be done. Okay, so let's look at what positive results we have for the case of Riemannian manifolds. So we are not talking now, for the next half hour or so at least, we are not talking about space-times, but just space. Because space itself is, of course, a Riemannian manifold. Then it evolves in time, and the whole thing then is a Lorentzian manifold. But space itself is a Riemannian manifold. Also, maybe you're familiar with Wick rotation. That means you can also describe a Lorentzian manifold then with certain conditions in a Wick rotated way as a Riemannian manifold. Then you can work with the four dimensions. You just have to be sure that you can undo that Wick rotation at the end. Super non-trivial, but for example, Stephen Hawking did that all the time. So you can get some places with that, but you have to be careful. It's not a generically it doesn't work. Okay, so here's a theorem that's going to be very important for what I want to cover today. Assume that we have a manifold and a metric on it, so a differentiable manifold and a metric tensor on it. And let's assume that it is a compact Riemannian manifold without a boundary. So compact, finite volume, and it doesn't have a boundary. So think of some metal surface, closed metal surface, no boundary, the shape of a potato or something like that. Okay, just some non-trivial shape. And then we will ask whether the sound that it makes when tapped with a spoon will tell us what the shape is. So the theorem says that if we have a compact Riemannian manifold without a boundary, then the spectrum of the Laplace operator, or of, in fact, of all the Laplace operators on that manifold is discrete. And not only is it discrete, it also has degeneracies that can be at most finite, no infinite degeneracies, and there are also no accumulation points. So what this means concretely is that in the case of your mug, the spectrum, the overtone spectrum of your mug is discrete all the way. That's different, for example, from the spectrum of the hydrogen atom. Remember that you have a discrete spectrum for the hydrogen atom, the spectrum of the Hamiltonian is discrete, and then it reaches a certain accumulation point, and then above that is a continuum. The continuum describes states where electrons are not caught and orbit around the nucleus, but where electrons are just scattering. So the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian of the hydrogen atom in the continuous spectrum describe slightly modified plane waves that describe electrons coming in from far, being scattered off the atom and going out far again. It's like a visitor from another solar system, which might come into our solar system, as happened last year, come into our solar system, it's too fast, goes around the sun, and goes away forever again. Whereas our comets, our own comets in the solar system, are in elliptic orbits. So they go always the same way. So our comets correspond to the discrete spectrum. And then those visitors from other solar systems correspond to the continuous spectrum when you translate all of that into atomic physics. Anyway, so that's typically for any quantum system, you have some low-lying discrete bound states, and then above you have the scattering states where the electrons come in too fast to stick to whatever object you have, and so they go out again. The harmonic oscillator doesn't allow for scattering states because it's confining potential forever, so it has only a discrete spectrum. Anyway, I went off on a tangent here. So your mark has a discrete spectrum forever. Okay, so there's no continuous spectrum there. And so, yep.
So I was wondering, since the number of holes in an object is also some kind of energy variant, like how does that relate to the spectrum, or is that something additional?
It comes out today in the lecture.
Okay.
Yeah. This will be the Betti numbers. Yes. Very good question. So we can describe any arbitrarily, okay, so if we have an arbitrarily large object, such as the universe, we can always just consider a chunk of it and do the spectral geometry of that and then make it bigger and bigger. Okay. So let us make this a little more precise now, what I did just with the pen on his mug. What kind of waves do we have on that manifold, like this metal thing here? Remember the formula for the Laplacian. It's given here by the exterior derivative, the co-derivation, the co-derivative, and then the co-derivative and the exterior derivative. I hope you remember that from one of the lectures that either Maria or Nitika gave. This Laplace operator can act on p-forms, and when it does, it will map a p-form into a p-form. How do we know that? Well, if this thing acts on a p-form, then the action of d on the p-form makes it a p plus 1 form. But the action of the co-derivative makes that p plus 1 form a p-form again, because this increases the degree by 1, and that decreases it by 1. And here it's first decreased and then increased. So overall, the Laplacian maps 2 forms into 2 forms, 3 forms into 3 forms, 0 forms into 0 forms, and so on. Okay? So we can look at the Laplacian separately on forms of each degree. So consider now p-form fields, let's call them omega of x, so some particular p-form on the manifold. And we're assuming a compact, no boundary manifold with some time evolution. So let's say we have here our metal surface in the shape of a potato or whatever. And then what kind of wave equations can you put there? Well, we can put, for example, the Schrödinger equation. So we have minus h bar squared over 2m, Laplacian acting on our what would be the wave function in this case. If the form that we are considering is a zero form, then this would be just the Schrödinger equation for, you know, scalar-valued wave functions. But this is just doing quantum mechanics on a non-trivial surface. That's how you would do it. If you want to do quantum mechanics, ordinary Schrödinger quantum mechanics, on a two-dimensional manifold, that's how you would do it. Here, that Laplacian is needed in the case for p equals 0 then. But on a generic such manifold, we also have 1 forms, 2 forms, 3 forms, etc., up to n forms if n is the dimension. So we can also do a Schrödinger equation for all of these. This would be covector valued, for example, if p is equal to 1. But also totally anti-symmetric tensor valued if p is equal to 2, such as the field strength in electromagnetism. But instead of the Schrödinger equation, we could also look at the heat equation. In this case, instead of IH bar, we have here just d by dt, and we have a minus. But we could also look at the Klein-Gordon equation and make the whole thing have on the left-hand side a second time derivative. And each one of these, oh, and this is the important part, for the zero forms, the spectrum may be different than it is for one form, than it is for two forms, etc. Now, why would that be? Let me explain that in a moment. Consider an earthquake. So an earthquake happens because somewhere in the Earth's crust, something is happening. Then waves will propagate away from that place and will go in all directions. Seismologists will measure those waves and then triangulate where the event happens, how deep down, how strong it was, and all that. Seismologists know that there's more than one kind of wave, though. You see, you can have waves where rock presses against rock, and these are just scalar pressure waves that propagate in this way. But you can also have that at the event where the earthquake happened, the rock sideways slipped against the rock instead of longitudinally, transversally. It can also have sheared in this way, right? So it could, there could be a rotation of rock against rock. And then whatever it happened, whether it was a sliding to the side or a shearing or a pressure, it will make different waves, right? Because a shearing will make a shear wave, right? The rock will then vibrate this way. And if it's a rotation, the rock will rotate like that. And these different modes of oscillation are entirely different things. They propagate at different speeds. And they have different dispersion relations, meaning that different wavelengths propagate at different speeds. And also different types of oscillation modes, even for the same wavelengths, will propagate at different speeds. So it's very important that we distinguish these things. For example, how do we know that the Earth has a liquid interior? We know that because there are different types of seismic waves. You see, a pressure wave will propagate through a solid as well as it propagates through a liquid. So if there's an earthquake in California, then the pressure waves will propagate through the crust, then through the liquid interior, and then come out at the other side again. But a shear wave that's generated with the earthquake will only propagate as far as the boundary between the solid crust and the liquid interior, and then reflect off that. And in this way, you can basically take an X-ray of the Earth, a seismic version of an X-ray of the Earth. So similarly, that's what we did here. We are looking at the Schrödinger equation, or at the heat equation, or at the Klein-Gordon equation for P forms of different P. And that means different kinds of vibration modes. P equals zero forms are just scalar, like pressure waves. And then you have also the other ones, the P equal 1, P equal 2, P equal 3 forms. And so we can imagine that when Weil asked, how much about the shape of the mark is deducible from the spectrum of the sound that it makes when tapped, Weil was not taking this into account, namely that actually the mark will vibrate with different vibrational modes. It will not only have pressure waves, there will also be shear waves. And what you really should do is put your ear directly onto the mark to hear everything, or shine a laser on it and then capture the vibration this way. Because the shear waves that the mark makes, we cannot hear. Because shear waves don't make it through the air. You see? In fact, the definition of a liquid is that it doesn't support shear. Right? There's no restoring force to shear. So there cannot be any waves there. So what we do here is we're trying to be more careful than Hermann Weyl and say, okay, we listen to at least all of the vibrational modes that there are so that we get the maximum amount of geometric invariance. There's going to be a spectrum for the scalar waves. There's going to be a spectrum for the vectorial waves and for the two-form waves, for the three-form waves, and so on. And then we can ask how much information do they contain, to what extent are they similar or even the same. Let's do this. Okay, so let's say we find an eigen differential form, like an eigenvector of the Laplacian on the manifold. So we have that the Laplacian on p-forms acting on this p-form is equal to eigenvalue times that p-form. How do we know they exist? Well, we know that because the Laplacian is a self-adjoint operator. So it has an eigenbasis by the spectral theorem. And the Laplacian on one forms has an eigenbasis, the Laplacian on two forms, p forms, etc. All of them have eigenbases. And the Laplacian is self-adjoint with respect to the inner product given in this way. I hope you remember that. I think it was in Nitika's lecture that came up. So remember that the inner product between a p-form omega and a p-form nu is given by the integral over the manifold of the p-form omega veg the Hodge star of the p-form nu. How is it that we can integrate this? Remember that omega is a p-form, nu is a p-form. The only thing that we can actually integrate over all of the manifold is an n-form, right? Because p-forms get integrated over p-dimensional manifolds and n-forms over n-dimensional ones. But this is an integral over the entire manifold m. So how come this is an n-form, is it? It's made out of two p-forms. Well, the thing is that omega appears here. Yeah, that's a p-form. And then we have nu is a p-form, but the Hodge star turns a p-form into an n minus p-form. Remember how that went? You take your p-form, view it as a tensor, and then because it's a form, it has only lower indices. Now you use the metric to raise all of those indices so that they all become contravariant, and you plug that into the volume form, and then you're filling p slots in there, leaving n minus p slots over, and that is what the Hodge star of nu is. Okay, so we have a p-form, veg, an n minus p-form, and of course that is then an n-form, and that's what we can integrate. That's the inner product between p-forms. Okay, so assume we found such an eigenform to our Laplacian on p-forms. Well, if we have that, then we can solve the Schrödinger equation, the heat equation, the Klein-Gordon equation, because literally, what we heard when we tapped the mark was the eigenvalues of the Laplacian on that surface. See, if you have an eigenfunction to omega, then you have that, I mean, this holds then, and then the Schrödinger equation is solved, for example, by exponentiating here that eigenenergy here. What I'm saying is that if you have the Schrödinger equation and you know an eigenfunction to the Hamiltonian, then you can write down the space-time dependence of it. You can write down the time dependence of it, right? You simply take the eigenstate of the Hamiltonian and multiply by e to the power of I, energy eigenvalue, times t over h bar. So that's what we get exactly here. And the same is true for the heat equation and the Klein-Gordon equation. My point being that we are done solving these equations of motion the moment we have found the eigenfunctions to the Laplacian. The eigenvalues to the Laplacian give us the frequencies with which these things vibrate. Okay, so the spectrum of the Laplacian on p-forms is the overtone spectrum of the p-forms that get excited when we tap a mark, for example. Except that this works not just for two dimensions. Now, what are the properties of the spectrum of the Laplacian on p-forms? Again, let me remind you that the Laplacian is given by this expression and that it maps p-forms into p-forms. So we can look at the space of p-forms separately for each p. So let's look at the Laplacian acting on a p-form. What spectrum does it have? And how does that spectrum differ for different values of p? We expect that for different values of p, just like in seismology, we get different information. For example, the information that allows us to tell that there's a transition from the solid crust to the liquid interior of the Earth. Now it turns out that there is actually a lot of similarity in the sound of, in terms of P waves and P plus one waves and P plus two waves and so on. So the Laplacian on P forms has a rather similar spectrum to the Laplacian on P plus one forms or P minus one forms or N minus P forms. There is not as much information in there as we might have hoped. Let me now explain exactly how we can calculate these things. It's pretty sophisticated stuff because we are getting geometric information, namely these geometric invariants, the spectrum, from algebraic manipulations. And the reason why the spectra of the Laplacians on p-forms are closely related, the fundamental reason for that is these commutation relations. The Laplacian commutes with a Hodge star. And that will, as we will see, imply that the spectrum on p-forms is going to be the same as the spectrum on n minus p-forms, because that's what the Hodge star does. It turns p-form into n minus p-form. And then we also have that the Laplacian commutes with the exterior derivative operator, and it also commutes with the co-derivative. Properties that you should have seen before with Nitika, but easy to check. And so there's going to be a relationship between the spectra that we are placing our hopes on to be able to describe the shape of a manifold in terms of spectra. So overall, what's going to happen is I will show you how to calculate the spectra for all the Laplacians on all the p-forms, and I mean how they are related to each other. And then we will conclude, unfortunately, not enough. Even if you know all those spectra, you cannot nail down exactly how the mug or whatever object it is looks like. There are counterexamples. And then I will go into what we can do about it. Okay? All right. So first, let us use this. Remember, our aim is to find the relationship between the spectra of Laplacians on p-forms and Laplacian on p plus 1 forms, and so on. OK, so let's use the fact that the Laplacian commutes with a Hodge star operator. Let's assume that omega is a p-form and that omega is an eigenform of the Laplacian on p-forms. OK, so omega is an eigenform to the Laplacian on p-forms. Then we define another differential form, nu, which is the Hodge star of omega. The Hodge star maps this p form into an n minus p form. Now, we will find out that this is also an eigenform. Let's calculate. So we apply the Laplacian on nu. But nu is by definition star omega. So we have the Laplacian acting on star omega. Now we use the commutativity. So we can write this as star Laplacian on omega. But we know by assumption that omega is an eigenform to the Laplacian. So this is lambda times omega. So this is lambda times nu, because star omega is nu. Lambda is just a number. We can pull that in front. So what we've seen is that if omega is an eigenfunction, is a p form that's an eigenfunction to the Laplacian, then we have now also found a differential form which is an eigenfunction to the Laplacian, but is an n minus p form. Right? So every p form eigenform is inducing an n minus p form nu that's also an eigenform to the Laplacian with the same eigenvalue lambda. And that means that the spectrum of the Laplacian on p-forms is the same as the spectrum of the Laplacian on n minus p-forms. That's a bit of a bummer, right? So if you look at one forms, for example, they will have exactly the same amount of information about the geometry as do n minus one forms. In four dimensions, it would be the one forms have the same amount of information as three forms. I mean, the sound in terms of one forms contains exactly the same amount of information as the sound on three forms, and zero forms and four forms, and so on. Okay, now let's use these other properties, namely that the Laplacian commutes with the exterior derivative and the Laplacian commutes with the co-derivative. This will relate the spectra even further. But first, let us do a decomposition of the space of p-forms that is super crucial in differential geometry in general, not just for this business of spectral geometry, but just in general. And here we start with the following observation. The Laplacian maps exact forms, or I hope you remember what an exact form is. An exact differential form is a differential form that's the D of another one. Okay? So we have alpha exact means there exists a beta such that alpha is D of beta. Okay? And then coexact is alpha is coexact means that there exists a beta such that alpha is co-derivative of beta. I should actually say gamma here, just not to confuse these things. You see, if alpha is a p-form, beta has to be a p-minus form, because d increases the degree by 1. Here, for co-exactness, the gamma has to be a p-plus 1 form, because the co-derivative reduces the degree of the form by 1. Oh, do you remember? There was a super important thing that we covered a few lectures ago. Differential p-forms can be exact, and then that means this. But there is another property that we had. Namely, we said that alpha is closed means d alpha is equal to 0. A differential form is closed. Oh, is it reflecting there? It's d alpha equal to 0. If d of alpha is equal to 0, then it's called closed. Now, you can easily see, I hope, that this always holds. Right? Because if alpha is the d of a beta, then if you apply another d on it, you have d squared. So clearly, any exact form is closed. But the opposite may not be true. It may not happen. It depends on the manifold, and that's super important that this depends on the manifold. If the manifold is what is called contractible, for example, if there are no holes in the manifold, if you can shrink it in a continuous fashion into a point, then that manifold, one can prove, has the property that it also works this way around. That every closed form is also exact, which is to say that if the d alpha is equal to 0, then it is the d of a beta. But in general, we don't know that. And if you remember, this was the lecture where I introduced category theory. Cohomology theories are about that. The Rahm cohomology is a theory of cohomology, which is all about that. It exploits the fact that when a manifold is non-trivial, if it has holes and handles like your mug, then there can be differential forms that are closed but not exact. Some of them may be closed and exact, some of them may not be closed and exact. And by measuring how many are closed but not exact, you are in effect measuring the non-triviality of the topology of the manifold, how many holes or handles or higher dimensional analogs of these things it has. And similar to co-closed, there's also co-closed. Co-closed means, so we have alpha is co-closed, means that del alpha is equal to 0, that the co-derivative is 0. And remember what the co-derivative is? It's basically the exterior derivative but with the hot star before and after, which means that the co-derivative lowers the degree when d is increasing the degree. Yeah, and then you can ask the same question here. If a differential form is co-closed, does it mean that it is co-exact? It depends. If the manifold is contractible to a point continuously, then yes. But if it's non-trivial, then there's a difference between the two, and we can measure that difference. That's the starting point for cohomology theories, especially for Durand cohomology, and that was the starting point for category theory. Because remember, in a higher dimensional, in the case of a high dimensional differential manifold, it's really hard to find out whether it has holes or handles. But just looking at the equations, it's difficult to figure that out. So it's good to have some algebraic tools, for example, checking whether or not some, there are differential forms that are closed without being exact, to be able to tell something about the overall topology in terms of holes and handles. Okay, so what did we have here? We have that the Laplacian maps exact forms into exact forms. That's a consequence of the statement that we just had, namely the statement that the D operator commutes with the Laplacian. Let's check that. So let's say omega is an exact form. So if omega is an exact form, then it can be written as the d of something, namely d of nu. So then we have the Laplacian acting on omega is the Laplacian acting on d nu. But since the d and the Laplacian commute, we can write this as the d applied to the Laplacian. But this is an exact form, right? Because it's the d of nu alpha. It's the d of the Laplacian acting on u. So the Laplacian acting on an exact form gives us something which is the d of something. So it's an exact form. So that means that the Laplacian maps the set of exact forms into the set of exact forms. So here the notation is d on lambda r is the set of r plus 1 form, which is exact. Right? So you think of lambda r as the space of r forms. If you apply the d to each one of them, you get an r plus 1 form. And we just write that the, what you get out of this d lambda r. Okay? So this is the set of r plus 1 forms, even though there's an r here. Keep in mind that the d increases the degree by 1. So this is the set of r plus 1 forms, which are of the form d of something, d of an r form. And what we just proved here is that the Laplacian maps exact r plus 1 forms into exact r plus 1 forms. And similarly, we can show, just by swapping the role of the d and the del, that the Laplacian also maps co-exact forms into co-exact forms. It's not just exact ones, but also co-exact ones. So the Laplacian maps the space of co-exact r plus 1 forms into the space of co-exact r plus 1 forms, but it's true for every r. So we can simply say the Laplacian maps co-exact r forms into co-exact r forms. Now, the Laplacian can also have eigenvalue 0. And this will have to do eventually with Barbara's point. So Laplacians can also have eigenvalue 0. And that means that the Laplacian is not mapping like this into co-exact or exact forms, but it's mapping into 0, right? Because eigenvalue 0 means annihilation. So let us look at that space too, the space that is annihilated by the Laplacian. So the Laplacian can map differential forms into 0. It may or may not, but we consider the possibility that the Laplacian maps differential forms into 0, which is to say it may have a kernel, it may have an eigenspace of eigenvalue 0. And let's give this a name. Let's write this space as the space of R forms, which are mapped into 0 by the action of the Laplacian. So this is the eigenspace to the Laplacian among the R forms. These are forms are called harmonic forms. Harmonic forms are simply the eigenvectors of the Laplacian with eigenvalue zero. So the Laplacian maps the space of harmonic R forms into zero. Okay. So what we've established now is that the Laplacian maps exact forms into exact forms, coexact forms into coexact forms, and it could also map some differential forms into zero. Is there anything else that the Laplacian could do? And it turns out, no, that's all it can do. And this is this important decomposition that I told you about, very important in differential geometry. We will not much use it later on in general relativity, but since we are doing this in differential geometry anyway, let's cover it. So the Hodge decomposition says that the space of P forms can be decomposed into a subset, which a subspace, which is exact P forms, a subset which is coexact P forms, and the harmonic ones that are being annihilated. This is pretty big if you think about it. So we look at all the P forms, and then what this is saying is that the space of all P forms can be decomposed uniquely into the exact P forms, the coexact P forms, and the harmonic forms that are annihilated by the Laplacian. And the Laplacian, more than that, the Laplacian maps these guys into themselves, maps these into themselves, and maps these into themselves, or more accurately, it annihilates those. You can think of the Laplacian in P forms as being block diagonalized by this, because it maps that space into itself, and that. So you can think of the Laplacian on P forms as acting on these two blocks there, and then it annihilates that. That's a zero in the bottom right corner there. And these spaces are orthogonal to each other. That's, if you remember, is what is implied when you have this direct sum. Direct sum means that this space has to be orthogonal to that one, to that one. So we have an orthogonal decomposition of the vector space of P forms into these three parts. And the Laplacian is acting on this one, separately on that one, separately on this one, which means it has a spectrum on this subspace. It has a spectrum on that subspace, spectrum on that subspace. So where are we with this? We said the Laplacian acts on all differential forms, but it maps P forms into P forms. It maps one forms into one forms, two forms into two forms, and further. The space of P forms gets decomposed in this way, and then it acts on these, and these. We would never have expected any such thing with the Mach, right? But that's what's happening. Mach, or a higher dimensional object, has all these P form waves on it, and then the P form waves decompose into the exact, the coexact, and the harmonic ones. And the Laplacian has separate spectra on each one of these. So why is this useful? Well, what it means is that every eigenvector of the Laplacian on P forms is either exact, coexact, or annihilated by the Laplacian. And every arbitrary P form is a linear combination of a P form that's exact, a P form that's coexact, and a P form that's zero. Okay. Now, not sure if we should go through all of the proof. Let's do some of it and then skip some of it. Okay, let's prove this. It is clear that the space of exact P forms, this is the space of exact P forms, if you remember, because it's you take an arbitrary P minus 1 form and apply a D to it, you get an exact P form, right? So it's clear that when you have an exact P form, and you take a coexact P form, then, it is clear that the exact, if you take a form in P, in the space of P minus one form, you apply a D to it, then that's a P form. And if you take a differential form, differential p plus one form, then the co-derivative of it is a differential p form. This is just, sorry, for a moment I thought it's saying more than it does. But it simply says that the d is raising the degree by one and the del is lowering the degree of the differential form by one. Okay, so now what we want to show is that this space is orthogonal to that space, because that was part of the decomposition that we had into the exact forms, exact p-forms, the co-exact p-forms, and then the harmonic forms. So let's assume that omega is an exact p-form, and that alpha is a co-exact p-form. So the omega arises from a p-minus form by applying d, and the alpha arises from a p-plus form by applying the co-derivative. Then we need to show that omega and alpha are orthogonal. So let's calculate the inner product of omega and alpha. Well, omega is d nu, and alpha is del of beta. Now, if you remember from Nitika's lecture, the co-derivative is anti-Hermitian. So we can put this on the other side and only just pick up a minus sign. And so what we obtain here is that we have two d's now on the left-hand side, but two d's is zero. So therefore, we can conclude that the whole thing here is zero. So we showed the orthogonality there. Now, next thing we need to show is that if we have a p-form and the p-form is orthogonal to the space of exact p-forms, and it is orthogonal to the space of co-exact p-forms, then it has to be a harmonic form. Because the statement was that it's got to be in, that this is a complete decomposition of the space of p-forms. It consists of the direct sum of the exact, the co-exact, and the harmonic forms. So if omega is orthogonal to the exact ones, orthogonal to the co-exact ones, well, then it's got to be harmonic. In the interest of time, because there's more to come, let me just skip the proof of that. It's the same tricks all over. Okay. And there's more to be proven. Among this proof, let me just focus on the bracket here. Because this is answering Barbara's question from earlier. So what we prove in the process here is that harmonic forms are closed and co-closed, but they are not exact, nor are they co-exact. We know that they cannot be exact or co-exact because of the decomposition, right? We have the decomposition of the p-forms into the exact and the co-exact and the harmonic ones. So the harmonic ones are certainly not exact or co-exact. But, as we prove here, they are closed and co-closed. Now let's go back to this. Remember, a differential form being exact means that it's the d of some differential form. And a differential form being closed means that the d of it is vanishing. And we said that this direction is easy. Any exact form has to be closed, because d squared is zero, right? If you apply the d on the alpha, zero. But we said that the other direction is only true if the manifold is trivial, right? If it's contractible. The exact statement is the other way around. If it is contractible, then it is true. So we get a handle on the non-triviality of a manifold, on the existence of, how deeply connected it is, whether there are holes and handles in there, by studying which forms are closed, but not exact. Like on a trivial space, every closed form would also be exact, and exact would be closed. But if that's not so, then we know that we have some non-triviality going on. And here we have our candidates, because what we have is that the harmonic forms, and that's why they're so important, the harmonic forms are closed, okay, so they're closed, but they're not exact. Which tells us that on a simple contractible manifold, we shouldn't have any. But if we do have, then we know that the manifold has to be non-trivial. And we also have the same for the co-exactness and co-closeness. So, how many harmonic forms exist? Or how high-dimensional the space of harmonic forms is telling us something about how non-trivial the topology of the manifold is. And remember, there are harmonic zero forms, harmonic one forms, harmonic two forms, harmonic three forms, etc., up to harmonic n forms. So for every p, we can ask, what's the dimension of the space of harmonic p forms? And that is called the Betti number. So the Betti number is the dimension of the space of harmonic p forms. The p's Betti number is the dimension of the space of harmonic p forms. And it measures the topological non-triviality of the manifold. So there is a way to keep track of holes and handles. However, it has to be said that while this method of calculating the Betti number for a manifold is good at detecting some non-trivialities, presence of holes and handles, it doesn't detect everything, which is why there are other cohomology theories and much more sophisticated things going on. But it's one handle. It's some measure of the non-triviality of a manifold. And remember, how do we do this now? Well, we take the manifold given, and we solve the equation Laplacian acting on p-form equal to zero. We're basically solving the Klein-Gordon equation, the Schrödinger equation, for eigenvalue zero. And then we ask, how many do we have? How many solutions do we have that are linearly independent? And these would be the Betti numbers then. Okay, so what conclusions can we draw so far? Here is the set of all differential forms, divided up into the pieces that we know the Laplacian acts separately on. So we know that the Laplacian maps the p minus 1 forms into themselves, maps the lambda, the p forms, the p plus 1 forms, etc., into themselves. And then we also know that the space of p forms decomposes into the exact p forms, the co-exact p forms, and the harmonic p forms. And the Laplacian maps this space into itself, maps that space into itself, and annihilates that space. So in particular, the Laplacian is a self-adjoint operator on this and has a spectrum. And the Laplacian is a self-adjoint operator on that and has a spectrum. And similarly here and there. So we have that the Laplacian has a spectrum on this space, on that space. Here, of course, the spectrum is 0, 0, 0. But it has a spectrum there, spectrum there, spectrum there, etc. And now we can ask, how are these spectra related? How much independent information do we get by putting our ear to his mug and listening not just to the pressure waves, but also to the shear waves? Well, the proposition is this, that the spectrum on the exact p-forms is the same as the spectrum on the co-exact, the spectrum on the space of exact r plus 1 forms, because these are r forms, then the d raises it by 1. So the spectrum on the exact r plus 1 forms is the same as the spectrum on co-exact r forms, because this thing lowers the degree by 1. Concretely, it means that the spectrum on the co-exact p minus 1 forms is the same as the spectrum on exact p forms. And so here we go from the p minus 1 to the p forms. And here again, this the spectrum that the Laplacian has on that subspace is the same as the spectrum that it has on that subspace. And it continues like this throughout all of the Grassmann algebra of differential forms. So it means that the spectrum here might be independent of the spectrum there, but that's the same spectrum as this. So there's the same geometric information in here as there is in there. Okay, so that limits how much the acoustics can tell us. Maybe in the interest of time, I'll skip that proof as well. Okay, so now let us use the fact that the Laplacian commutes with the Hodge star operation. From that, we can conclude another important property of the spectra, namely that the spectrum, first of all, we know that the Hodge star is going to map the exact r plus 1 forms into the coexact n minus r minus 1 forms. So let's prove this. Assume that omega is an exact form, and nu is the Hodge star of that. So if this is an r plus 1 form, because rho is an r form, then if this is a r plus 1 form, then this is an n minus r minus 1 form, because that's what the Hodge star does. And then if we spell out what that is, the omega is the d of rho. And then we spell out what the co-derivative is. So here we write star d, and here we have star d. But then we put two stars together. Remember that applying the Hodge star twice gives you the identity up to some prefactor of minus 1, possibly. So we put that in here. And in this way, we get the star d star involved, which over there, you see, is the co-derivative. So we find that it is the co-derivative of star rho. And this is the co-derivative of alpha, where alpha is defined to be this expression here, the star rho, including this thing over here. But the co-derivative of alpha is, whatever it might be, it is a co-exact form, because it is the co-derivative of something. So this is an element of the space of co-exact n minus r minus 1 form. So therefore, as advertised, we have that the Hodge star maps co-exact. It means that it maps the exact r plus 1 forms into the coexact n minus r minus 1 forms. And then you can do the same way, just swapping the d's and the del's, you can prove this. But it also maps this space into that space. And now, since we know that, and we also know that the Hodge star commutes with the Laplacian, we can conclude the following. Because remember, we already showed that the Hodge star preserves the spectrum of the Laplacian, but it maps these spaces into each other. So what do we have now in this, in the sound of the mug? What independent degrees of freedom are there now? So we had this already, namely that the spectrum of the Laplacian on here is the same as there, here is the same as there. I mean, these might be different from those, right? It's just having these pairwise equalities. But now we've also found that if we look here at the p forms and the n minus p forms, but these are just neighboring layers here, right? But these are distant layers in general. So if we look at the p forms and the n minus p forms, then we have that the coexact ones here have the same spectrum as the exact ones over there, and vice versa. So what we have is this cross equalities here, and then also, I mean, from bottom to up, and here also between these neighboring layers. And that gives us a lot of degeneracy in here. A lot of spectra are the same. Let us look at the example here of dimension 3. There, by the Hodge decomposition, we have that the space of zero forms is the space of coexact forms plus the harmonic forms. There cannot be any exact forms because a zero form cannot be the D of anything, because that would have to be a minus one form, doesn't exist. So here we have for dimension 3 the four subspaces of P forms that decompose in this way. And then equal color means equal spectrum. Right? We know that these must have the same spectrum because of what we just proved with the hot star. But we also have that these had to be the same spectrum, and those had to be the same spectrum. These two have to be the same spectrum. So overall, we have only two independent spectra in this. Still better than one. If we only looked at the scalar sound that we can hear through the air, we would have captured only this. But in this way, we take the red spectrum as well, and that gives us some more information. But surprisingly, perhaps, it's not all that much more information that we get. And so it happens that the spectra of the Laplacian, of this Laplacian, I have to say, do not contain sufficient information in general to uniquely identify the Riemannian structure from the spectra alone. So Weyl's question of 1911 has to be answered in the negative if that's what we do. If we look at the Laplacian and all possible differential forms, then we don't have all that many independent spectra, as we just saw. And examples have been found over the past 100 years. This is a difficult subject, but there has been some literature on this. Examples have been found of pairs of manifolds with metrics which are isospectral for that Laplacian. For all differential forms, they have the same spectrum. But these two manifolds are known not to be the same, not to have the same metric. They're not isometric. They're not in the same Riemannian structure. So that means we can describe a lot about the shape of something in terms of spectra, in terms of geometric invariance, but not all of it, which means that it's difficult. It's not easy to see how we could quantize using this, except we may have, there may be a way out. First of all, it has to be said that the manifolds that provide counterexamples all have some kind of drawback that makes them unphysical. For example, this could be manifolds that are locally isomorphic, but not globally. Could be that they are basically cutouts of each other and then rearranged in different shapes. And also, there are counterexamples that are only counterexamples for some Laplacians on certain p-forms, but not on all p-forms. And some examples are simply trivial because it's just a manifold in its mirror image. But ultimately, the problem persists. And so let me just give you a hint of what can be done about this. So students and I have been looking at how we can fix this. What might have been overlooked in this? And what we think has been overlooked is that we are looking here only at the vibration spectrum of P forms. But what matters in the shape of a manifold is the metric. And the metric is not a P form. The metric is a covariant symmetric two tensor. And you can define a Laplace operator on covariant symmetric two tensors and calculate its spectrum. That is independent of all these calculations that we did today. It's a different amount of info, it's a different kind of information that we get. Generally, we can have waves other than just the p-form waves, for example, gravitational waves. They wouldn't be covered here at all. OK, so our strategy has been this, a completely different strategy. You see, pure mathematicians either solve a problem or they don't. You either prove something or you don't. But coming from physics, there's another idea, which is approximations, perturbation theory. So the way we did it is the following. We said the problem of calculating the shape of something from its spectra is too hard. because it's super nonlinear. Imagine you're given the shape of a manifold, and then you solve some wave equation, whether it be for gravitational waves or electromagnetism or some differential forms. Solving that wave equation means diagonalizing the Laplacian on that curved background can be super difficult to do. It's a super nonlinear map over to the spectrum or spectra. Right? I'm writing here the possibility that we're looking at several spectra for several different Laplace operators for different tensors. But the problem of spectral geometry is an even harder one, because there we want to do the inverse and go from the spectrum and reconstruct what the shape of the manifold was. So we thought, okay, let's start from scratch and say this is too hard. We don't want to calculate the shape of a manifold directly from a bunch of spectra. Whatever clever spectra we find, we don't even attempt to do this right away. Instead, we assume we know the spectra and we know the shape of the manifold. So it looks at first as if we gave ourselves no task whatsoever. However, and then we say, imagine somebody perturbs now our manifold and lets it grow a bump or a dent or something like this. Then that small change in the shape will show up as a small change in the sound. In other words, there is a map from here to there, from the metric to the spectrum, and we're looking at the tangent to that map. Which is to say, if you do a small change over here in the metric, then you get a small change in the spectrum. And this tangent map, it's a high, very high-dimensional map, right? It's not a tangent geometrically. It's in the space of metrics. So the map from the space of metrics into the space of spectra. We calculate the tangent to that. And so that we can calculate for any small change in the shape, the small change in the spectrum. Why small? Why don't we have the ambition to calculate the whole thing? Too hard, nonlinear. But if we do it just for small, then the map is linear. It's the point of linearization, right? The first order approximation is linear. And so what we get is a matrix that maps the coefficients of the change of shape into the coefficients of the change of spectrum. That's a matrix. And matrices can be inverted. I mean, if the determinant is not zero, we can invert them. And that means that from a small change of spectrum, we can then calculate what the corresponding small change of shape was. So to recapitulate, the problem that we are addressing is this. Assume we know the shape of a manifold and we know its spectrum. Then, from a small change of sound, we want to reconstruct what the small change of shape was. And we do it by calculating it this way, but only for infinitesimal changes of shape, infinitesimal changes of spectrum, and then get a matrix, which we then invert. Let me give you a small indication. Actually, we are running out of time. Let me just give you the gist of it then. If we can do the infinitesimal inverse spectral geometry in this way, then we can iterate that. Remember how we integrate. If we want to know the area under a curve, well, then how do we do that? We can calculate the area in a rectangle, but under a curve, that's tough. So what we do is we split the integral up, and we say, this is the area that we want. Then we split it up into little rectangles, and we make them very, very thin. So that basically the fact that this is curved doesn't matter anymore. And then we just calculate here this rectangle's area and that one's and so on. Add them all up and take the limit for infinitely many subdivisions, and then we get the area, right? That's how we do it with spectral geometry. We go tiny, tiny steps. So for example, if somebody gives us a shape of a potato, not by giving us the shape, but by giving us the spectrum or the spectra, then how do we reconstruct the shape? All we have is the sound of it in one or several spectra, right? Like for zero forms and maybe for covariant symmetric two tensors, all of these types of waves have their own spectrum. How do we do it? Well, then we start with a sphere. We start with a sphere, we know its shape, and we know how it sounds, because we can solve that problem analytically. So we have the spectrum right there. And then we compare the spectrum with the spectrum that we were given. And we will generally find it's a different spectrum, so we have work to do. If it was the same spectrum, we would say, hey, you gave us the spectrum of a sphere, we're done. But if it's a different spectrum, then we say, in the space of spectra, we now draw a straight line from the spectrum of a sphere to the spectrum that we were given. And then we take a tiny little step from the spectrum of a sphere in the direction of the spectrum that we were given. And that tiny little step in the space of spectra, we can calculate by inverting the tangent map what that means as a tiny little change of the shape of the manifold. So now our starting object, sphere for example, grows a bump. And then we go a little bit further in the direction of the target spectrum iteratively. And as we do that, this thing starts getting non-trivial shapes. And at the end, we get the potato we started, that we were supposed to get. We actually wrote some code for that. And one of the things I'd like to see one day is that we have an app where on one phone, you can design a shape and then have the machine calculate the sound of that, play it. The other phone picks up the sound and recreates the shape. For two-dimensional surfaces, you can actually do it with a scalar spectrum. That's the case we actually did numerically. So for two-dimensional ones, we can generically do it. We can't get the orientation because if you take a potato and its mirror image in the mirror, they sound the same. Can't distinguish that, right? But in general, we showed we can distinguish the shapes. But we also understood by going through the analysis of all this, and I have some more about this in the later slides if you're interested in this. We also showed that for dimensions larger than 2, it cannot suffice to just look at one spectrum. And we now know from the lecture today that the P forms also don't suffice. But we have strong evidence, not a firm mathematical proof, but strong evidence that if we work with the Laplacian, the wave equation, for covariant symmetric 2 tensors, such as the metric, then that spectrum should be enough. At least locally, it will be enough. But whether we can integrate it and get uniquely the answer, we don't know. Any case, this is still the Riemannian signature case. There's still a long way to go to do this for the Lorentzian case for space-time. So we basically can do it for space, for small neighborhoods of manifolds. What we would like to do is do it globally, to really iterate it up for the case of higher dimensions. And then we still have to do it for space-time, where things change quite considerably, because the Laplacian, because lots of these functional analytic things, like the spectral theorem, don't really apply in this case anymore. Because certain operators that are Hermitian are no longer Hermitian. So it's a whole different story than in this case. But in any case, it's super difficult, but the prospect is amazing, because if it could be done, then we would be able to describe geometries, not just two-dimensional ones like bugs. We could describe any arbitrary space-time in terms of geometric invariance, and that should make it much easier to quantize the theory then. Even if you can only do it perturbatively, like this iterative thing, we should be able to do at least iterative quantum gravity. Perturbative quantum gravity in this way. Anyway, I gave talks about the technicalities of these things. For example, I talked pretty much a year ago, I think in September of last year, here at PI, in a formal seminar on this. So if you look me up in Pearsa, and check out the research talk that I gave a year ago, then you will find the latest in this stuff. Okay, that's it for today.